This is Brent Kelly. I wrote you a week or so ago about an interview.
Yeah.
Is this a good time?
Brett, you want to do it by telephone?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, if you know.
Now, where are you, Brett?
I'm in Lexington, Kentucky.
Yeah, I'll know now, Brett.
Okay.
Okay.
If it's not you, I'll be happy to call back if you know, if it'd be better.
Listen, if you don't mind, how about calling back about 8:30?
Okay.
Suit you all right?
It should. It depends on whether I'm a veterinarian. If I get a call, I'll have to go.
I
but as it stands right now, I've got a dead morning, so it shouldn't be any problem at all.
Okay. Well, now I think it'll be fine with me, Brett. Let me turn this TV off.
Okay.
How you doing this morning?
Oh, pretty good. A little bit.
Well,
it rained last night a little bit, but doggone it, as soon as it does, it evaporates and gets hotter than Hades again.
That's where it is. It rained yesterday afternoon. It really got hot late afternoon.
We went over to see the Redbirds play the Omaha Royals last night in Louisville.
Oh, really?
And got a steady sprinkle almost, I think, the last half of the game. Wasn't enough to cause any harm, except it was just irritating. Well, Billy, let me tell you, I really appreciate this. I know it's taking time away from you, these things, the baseball fans read these and find a lot of interest in them, and I appreciate your time. And one of the things that will result from this...
Brett, I just want to be sure now. It's
okay.
B-R-E-T-T.
B-R-E-N-T.
N-T.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Brent Kelly.
Yes, sir.
K-E-L.
L-E-Y.
L-E-Y. Okay.
Yes, sir.
I just want to be sure.
Okay. One of the side effects of these, when this is printed, you'll get an increase in your number of autograph requests for a period of 2 or 3 weeks. If that's a problem, we'll try to work around that.
No problem at all.
Okay, great. That's good. I like that attitude. Some fellows don't seem to want to acknowledge the fans.
I feel that the only thing that hurts my feelings, though, I used to get letters from kids that said, my father... used to see you play ball. Now I'm getting them, and they say my grandfather. So that hurts my feelings. It's true, I know.
And the next step might not be too far away.
Well, I'll make that one not too far.
Well, I used to see you play ball, so you know my kids can write those other letters. But I've been around long enough to where I remember you. Okay, start out with college. You were a top college football player.
Yes, I played football at Auburn in 1935, 1936, and 1937. Yeah.
Was there any consideration of professional football?
Well, I had a conversation with Mr. Bell with the Philadelphia Eagles at that time, but that's all it was, just conversation, because I had made up my mind that I was going to play professional baseball, and scouts had contacted me. As soon as I finished all what I signed with the Yankees.
Okay. What about your brother? Now, he was All-American, was he not?
Jimmy was Auburn's first All-American in 1932, and of course, he had an opportunity to play football, but he also turned it down because he was involved in baseball, and he'd also signed with the Yankees in 1933 when he finished Auburn.
I didn't know he signed with the Yankees. I knew he came up with the Braves eventually.
Yeah, he was in the Yankee organization, let's see, from 1933. And let's see, 1937, he played at Oakland on the Coast League, still in the Yankee organization.
Mm-hmm.
Then at Chattanooga in 1938-39, and at the end of the 38th season, the old Boston club called him up for a look at the end of the season. And he played just a very few games, but they turned him back to Chattanooga, and he played there again in 39.
How long did he play after that? Was that it?
He played in 1940 at Columbus in the American Association, and I was at Kansas City, so we played against each other that year. And as you know, he would come back during the off season, during the winter, and was the backfield coach at Auburn.
Mm-hmm.
He was my backfield coach at Auburn.
I didn't realize that. I guess if I'd have thought about it, I would have known that. Yeah.
And he was made baseball coach and also football coach at Auburn until he went to Navy.
Was he rougher on you than he would have been on the other boys?
I think he probably a little more demanding, yes.
I think it's natural. Well, you started, the Yankees signed you, at the top of the chain.
Well, I was very fortunate. I went to spring training with Kansas City at that time. That was Double A, which was top at that time, now Triple A, of course. And we had a bunch of young fellas down there, Phil Rizzuto pretty, and I was, I was a first-year man. They had played two or three years in the lower minors, and I was just fortunate enough to have a good spring and fit in. And Jack Salsgrave, the old Yankee infielder, was the third baseman. Of course, Jack had little years on him, a few years on him, and he couldn't play every day. Johnny Stern was the first baseman. Johnny had been around a little bit. So Bill Meyer, the manager, just said, well, I'll just take you along, you know, as my fifth infielder. And I had an opportunity to play third base some that year in a couple of games at shortstop when Rizzuto was out, something like that. So things worked out real well for me that first year, and I stayed there 3 years.
Well, you were in a lineup, well, not every day, but three out of four anyhow.
Yeah.
That year.
Well, I was. I had an opportunity to play and got off to a good start. Had a good spring training, and things went well for me, and I was very fortunate.
What was your best position? You played darn near regularly, almost everywhere at one time or another in the infield.
I would say that the third base was probably my best position defensively.
Okay. Was that your most comfortable there, obviously?
I think so, yeah. I enjoyed it. First base was really the easiest position to play because I never had played the first base until late in my career, but I enjoyed playing first base. It was a lot of fun over there. You were in on everything, you know. And,
yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Well, how did the Tigers get you?
They bought me from the Yankees at the end of the 1941 season. At that time, the Yankees had two AAA clubs. You know, they had Newark and Kansas City, and had a lot of fine young ball players.
They sure did.
Prior to that, you know, the Yankees would have a young player, and they'd control him for 5 or 6 years, you know, with the option rule. Couldn't do it these days, but they did then. And finally, they began to sort of break that club up and sell some of their young players, which they did. They sold me at the end of the 41 season to the Tigers.
And you played more games at shortstop, I guess, than anybody else for the Tigers that year.
85 games at shortstop in 1942, and then I left in August 13th to go into service.
But this was a draft, or did you enlist?
I had a commission from Auburn, ROTC commission, in field artillery.
Uh-huh.
And I had had a physical in 1941. I don't have to call this. Poor Pearl Harbor, so they gave me a physical. And I had some knee trouble, had the knee operation. And then I had a little trouble with it playing ball, so they put me on the inactive list at that time. And then after Pearl Harbor, of course, things were different. And in August of 1942, I didn't get a telegram to go have a physical taken. I got a telegram to report for duty. And the Air Corps at this time was a new branch of service. And what they did, they transferred a lot of officers, reserve officers, from one branch of the service to another, to the Air Corps. So I was transferred from the field artillery to the Air Corps and reported for duty there.
Okay. Did you were decorated in the war?
Well, I just was in a place where a little, no action was going on. I was a special service officer, and at that time they gave some honors, you know, for being doing the job and so forth. I was special service officer for the Air Force overseas in the Pacific Ocean area, which was a big outfit, you know, and just was fortunate enough to be honored with that.
Did you play any ball at all in the service?
Yeah, this was it. We had a situation at Hickam Field in Honolulu, I should say, where we had three Air Force teams over there. And, of course, a lot of fellas had been transferred overseas to Honolulu. We moved them around from Hickam Field to Bellis Field to Wheeler Field, and had three teams, and most of the major league players, really. But we had about 42 players, and 38 of them were major league players.
Wow.
And the Navy had just had a wonderful team over there, and they just tore the Air Force up in 1943. So the generals over there said, well, we need some of these boys from the Air Force over here on our team. And the idea was to provide entertainment for the service personnel. The islands were just full of service people, you know.
Sure.
And they'd on the bases and played down at Honolulu Stadium. And that was a great entertainment for the service personnel. You know, that all the fellas were big baseball fans.
Mm-hmm.
So we're there, and then we got a telegram one day and saying that from Guam, and the commanding general down there saying that these 42 ball players should proceed to the forward areas to provide entertainment for these fellas down here that are making these flights over Japan and doing the real fighting down here. They got plenty of entertainment back in Honolulu. So this is exactly what happened, Brent. Loaded up 42 three-ball players on a boat one day, and a third of them went to Saipan, and two-thirds of them went to Tinian, and the ball fields, the engineers got busy, and the ball players helped build two diamonds on Tinian, and one diamond on Saipan, and we played baseball in opening day at Tinian. Right interesting the way they did it. They made these stands out of bomb crates. They put one bomb crate for the first row and then stacked one on the other right up and built bleachers. And I have pictures that show the opening day crowd there, Kenyon, and it just bring in the army trucks, you know, and jeeps and so forth, and park around the outfield grass beyond the little fence they built. And the soldiers were packed all on those trucks, and then the heavy equipment they'd had to use, cranes and so forth. I pictured the fellas on those cranes, five or six up, just all the way up in there watching the ball game. And it was about 12,000 soldiers there for that opening. Just scattered everywhere, all over the field, and just didn't have much foul line because they were sitting in the foul territory. And it was just a great event. The kids, it gave them some relief from their hard work, you know. I mean,
like sure.
And just remember flying a lot of flights over Japan at that time, bombing, and they come back, you know, they needed a little entertainment.
My stepfather was a paratrooper, and he told me stories that, it may well have been you. Teams came in, I don't remember where he was now, but they played just on the only open area they had, and they said everybody on the island was there.
That's right.
It was the best thing that had happened to them. He said in 2 years, when the ball clubs came through there, it was sometime late in the war, so it possibly could have been you.
Yeah. Well, I'll never forget so many times people like Enos Slaughter. Because Slaughter had the reputation of being a hustling ball player.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, he played just that way on those islands, and those hard carved infields, he'd slide and come up with strawberries. He played hard, and the kids really, they appreciated him. They enjoyed him.
Certainly.
Of course, things were pretty much over at Iwo Jima, but the Seabees cut a field in the side of a hill up there, looks like, a hill stand. We went up there and stayed, played a week. We'd play, the three teams would play change of schedule, and then the last day we play American League, National League All-Star game. When we played in the afternoon, they counted the number of troops there to be about 12,000 feet. And then that night, Bob Hope was there on a USO show, and he had 15,000 people. So that's the kind of entertainment that went on.
Mm-hmm.
All my buddies always tease me about that war that I fought, you know, playing baseball. But I realized that this was something that was necessary for these troops. And as you know, the USO did such a great job. And out of our office, you know, we had a special service officer, and they had all sorts of entertainment. And we had tennis players, Don Buzz and Bobby Riggs, and several would put on tennis exhibitions, you know. And the kids just, they missed it. They had seen these things back at home, you know, during their life. Routine, and they missed it, and it gave them something to do on those islands, because it was tough.
Well, morale is every bit as important as pulling a trigger, maybe more so.
Well, it surely is. You've got to have that fellow in a proper mental condition to fight a war if he's going to do a job for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes for anything, you know. It's, your mental condition is so important.
Certainly.
You might do.
That's right. It's too often overlooked, even in the everyday world.
So.
Well, you got out of the war eventually, thank goodness, and you came back to Detroit, bounced around for a couple, three teams. It seems like the older you got, the better hitter you were.
Well, I like to think that, Brent. I guess I matured a little bit, and you know, I, at one time I worried so much about, you know, if I didn't seem like if I didn't get a hit every time, I worried. Well, that meant that was a lot of worrying because I didn't get a hit every time. And I had the good fortune of playing with some fine, mature ball players, experienced ball players. And I guess if I had to pick one, a lot of them helped me. Believe me, they did.
Mm-hmm.
But I played with Wally Moses. Wally's the old Chicago outfielder down in South Georgia.
Just passed away here in the last year or so.
Sure did. A fine fella and a real great ball player. He was a good hitter and a good runner, and he could really play. And he had a great idea about hitting. You know, he used to talk to me. He says, "This is not going to get a hit every time you walk up there. Just try to adopt a philosophy of you go to that plate, you're going to give it your best shot. That pitcher gets you out that time, so I'll be back again. I'll get him next time." And that was sort of a philosophical approach to hitting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I was I weighed 180 pounds, but I wasn't a big, strong guy, you know. And I had a right field stroke, so Wally used to tell me, says, "Just don't try to pull the ball. Just try to hit the ball right back through the box and get the bat on the ball." So when I became a right field hitter, I think I became a little better hitter, and it helped me a great deal.
He helped a lot of fellows along the years.
Oh, yes. And, of course, I had those years, with 2 years with Ted Williams, watching and listening to him. And he was a great teacher, not only a great hitter. He made himself a great hitter, but he was a good teacher, too, and had great theories about hitting. He could carry out those theories. Not many people could do that. Like
indeed. You mentioned him. Obviously, you know, maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but was he the best you ever saw?
He's the best hitter I've ever seen. I don't want to say this. I spent all my time in the American League, so I didn't see a day in and day out fellas like Stan Hughes. But Williams is the greatest hitter I've ever seen. And as far as a player, all-around player, I think I'd have to say Joe DiMaggio. Everything. But Williams was a great hitter. He worked at it, Brent. I was not playing regular. I had a pretty good arm. He could throw good batting practice. So Ted went a couple of 3 days without really hitting the ball good. He wanted to get at that ballpark early, 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. I'd go out and throw batting practice to him. He'd hit to get his stroke and his timing back. And a wonderful thing about him, he'd hit for 30 or 40 minutes. And when he got through, he said, get your bat. I'm going to throw you. He'd want to throw to the fellow that pitched batting practice to him, too.
Yeah, that's all right. I talked to somebody just recently, and I don't remember who it was right now. He said when they came into Boston, they'd be bored, not have anything to do, and they'd go out to the ballpark maybe 4 or 5 hours before a game just to have something to get out of the hotel. And Williams would be out there taking batting practice. Whoever he'd get a hold of would be out there throwing to him.
Clubhouse boy, Vince Orlando, used to throw batting practice to him. And Mr. Yawkey, in his younger days, would come out and work out with Ted some. But Vince Orlando was a clubhouse boy. He was Ted's number one in the batting practice pitcher. But the fellows who weren't playing, you know, would come out there a lot of times with him and throw to him.
Well, he certainly did do a good job with it. Well, talking about the best, what about the best pitcher you saw?
Well, there were a lot of good ones. There were a lot of good ones those times. I'd have to say Feller was the best pitcher. Now, I didn't see Bob Feller before the service, and all the fellas that did hit against him before the war said that he lost a little bit off his fastball after he came back. By goodness, he had such a good curveball, and he developed a slider. 946 when he struck out, 50 hitters, he had a good slider, and you just couldn't sit on a fella's fastball. And of course, he was just wild enough to be effective, and he had that big high kick that hit the ball from him. So I'd say fella had to be the best pitcher. But I saw fellas like Allie Reynolds, Hal Newhouse, Big Rasher, fellas like that, were good pitchers too. Fella like Eddie Lopez. Eddie just passed away a couple of 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
sentiment. We were together at Montreal. But he was a good pitcher because he had control of all his pitches, you know, and he was sneaky fast and threw you a lot of sloppy stuff, slow curve, turn the ball over, and then zip, he'd throw the fastball by you. So he was a tough pitcher. Bob Lemon, awful tough. Early win. He was a mean rascal on that mound. You know, he'd knock you down if you dug in on him. But Early was a good pitcher. He was a high ball pitcher. Had to throw, get away with high sliders, but he was tough. Won over 300 games. Bob Lemon, sinker, curve, good pitcher. And of course, they had a great pitching staff over there.
They sure did.
Lemon and Fowler and Garcia. Later on, Hal Newhouse came in from Detroit and joined that pitching staff. But those are some of the pitchers that were tough. But I say all of them were tough for me. I tell you, Fowler was tough on me. Was Sid Hudson. Sid was big, tall, slender right-hander, sort of a three-quarter guy, and had a good sinking fastball, and he'd just take the bat right out of my hand. But he was a fine pitcher, good hitter, too, good fielder.
I interviewed him a few months ago, and just an awfully, yeah, Waco, awfully, awfully nice fellow.
Nice fellow.
It really was.
Old Towns game about 3 years ago up in North Georgia. He's a fine fellow.
He was stuck with a pretty poor team most of the time, which was a shame. Well, where were we? Okay, is there one game that stands out in your mind? Maybe not necessarily something you did, but maybe that somebody else did, or just something that you took part in that really sticks with you?
Well, this came late in my career. In fact, it was the most thrilling moment I've ever been in baseball, I think. Brentwood, the first night that I became manager of the Atlanta Braves. We were in Atlanta playing the Dodgers. And, I was late manager that morning, and of course, who would face that night but Sandy Koufax?
Oh, boy.
And then Denver LeMaster was our pitcher of the night, so these two left-handers hooked up in a real deal. And just a little background on this thing, Felipe Lewitt was our first baseman. He'd been playing from center field for the first base. Been hitting third and fourth and fifth, and Philippe liked to lead off. He was a strong hitter and a home run hitter, you know. He did 25, 30 home runs. And I'm going back a little bit now, this sort of history, but Hank Bauer was one of my coaches at Baltimore in 63. And I used to ask him, Hank, why in the world did Casey Stengel lead you off? So here you are, a home run hitter, hit 20, 25 home runs, he got you leading off. He said, well, the old man used to make me so mad. I didn't like to lead off. I like to hit down there where I could knock some runs in. The Stinger would tell him, listen, Bauer, you're the first man hitting. He says, at the bottom of the first inning, we might be ahead 1-0. And Hank says, you know, same thing. I hit a lot of home runs leading off.
Mm-hmm.
So in talking to Philippe that night, I said, Philippe, you're going to be the leadoff man. And I told him that little story. The other thing I did, Eddie Matthews was on the sort of over the hill, so to speak, but he had a lot of good baseball left in him. And I'd go out early and would pitch, you know, the pitches that Eddie would hit. And I felt like Eddie could still play it. He'd been in and out of the lineup. So I told him, I said, Eddie, you're the third baseman now. The rest of the season, against left-handers, against right-handers, if you get a little tired, you get out there for a couple, 3 days, but you're going to play third base. And he looked at me like I was crazy. So he said, you know, who's pitching right now? Well, it's a long story short, it sounds sort of strange, but this is a true story. There were 3,000 people in the stands that night. The rainy night had two or three rain delays. The game finally ended about 1 o'clock in the morning. Philippe Lou leads off the ball game with a home run. So it's 1-0. And it's 1-0 up through the eighth inning. And Jim LaFever, the Cub manager now, hit a home run off of LeMaster to tie it up 1-1. So we go in the bottom of the ninth, two men out. Eddie Matthews is the hitter. And Eddie told me this story later. He said, I was walking to the plate looking on my shoulder thinking he was going to use a hitter for me. But anyway, he hit. And the second pitch, he got a long drive down the right field line. It was about 4 or 5 feet foul. And we thought the ball game was over. The whole dugout rushed out to see whether it was pay or foul. And about two pitches later, he hit another drive in the right field, but this one was fair, it was a home run, won the ball game 2-1. Well, I don't think any of the 52,000 people that were there that night had left. They all stayed. It was a pitcher's battle and just great pitching by Koufax and LeMaster, and all the runs were scored on home runs. Well, the dugout erupted and just met Eddie at home plate and just picked him up and took him to the dugout. Just really excitement. And in the clubhouse, it was just bedlam. And Matthew said later, he said, "I've been in World Series and winning World Series games, but I've never had this much excitement in all my life." Well, to me, it was just one of those nights when people ask about the one game that this one always comes to mind. It was just the greatest, one of the greatest ball games I've ever seen to have it end like it did.
And LeMaster went all the way?
LeMaster went all the way and went 2-1.
That's all right. Yeah, that's Matthews, I was living in Lawrenceville, Georgia at that time. Saw the Braves play a few times. Now, the Matthews was winding down pretty rapidly at that point.
Yeah. He's a great player, Eddie.
My brother went to high school with him. He was a year behind him in Santa Barbara.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
he was a good player.
They played football together, yeah.
And, you know, Hank, of course, was a big home run hitter, but he was really behind Matthews, and Eddie was captain, you know, and that's the way it should have been. He was a great leader on the field. He played hard all the time.
Don't think he got a good shot as a manager.
Well, I don't think so. I think probably his personal habits got him in a little trouble there, and he didn't hee-haw very much with, I guess, Richard was still there. I guess Richard finally got rid of Torrey, too, you know.
So, yeah.
But Eddie went on to Houston, you know, and played a little bit out there, and then ended up at Detroit and did some designated hitting for Detroit.
Now he really helped him to that World Series. That was 68, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a good player.
Yes.
I really felt strongly that Eddie Matthews should have finished out his career in a Braves uniform. I was very much opposed to the trade to Houston. I got Bob Bruce, a big right-hand pitcher for him, but Richard wanted to trade him. He says, I told him, Paul, I said, Paul, he can play some, of course, we got Boy, you know, to play third base. I said, he can play some first base, he can pinch it. He said, listen, he'll be in that dugout, he'll drive you crazy. I said, I'll take chances on him. But Richard was the boss, so he traded him.
Richard did a lot of good things. Some of the things maybe a little bit iffy along the way.
I always felt that he was good at taking old pitches, you know, retreads, and teaching them that slip pitch. It'd make them good pitchers for a couple of 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Bad on the arm. A lot of bad arms.
Yeah, but they were a lot. Well, he took those young guys like Estrada and a few of those other fellas.
Estrada ended up with a bad arm. And,
yeah.
And Bob always had a bad arm, but was a good pitcher. Jack Fisher didn't bother him. And, of course, Pappas never did throw. He did food. He had a good slider, you know. Well, consequently, he stayed strong all the time.
For a long time. Well, talk about your managerial career. You were a very successful manager. You had a 5-12 winning percentage. When you took the Braves over, they couldn't beat you.
Well, we finished up the season real good. We had a good ball club, had good hitting, and our pitching was pretty good. And the fellas had a new lease on life, you know, and we relaxed a little bit, and we played good at the end of the season. In fact, they talk about that streak, 19 out of 21, I think that came in 1966 at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were 38-13, something like that, in the last 50 games. So we ended up the season real good. And things just didn't work out in 67 like we'd hoped it would.
What about your time with the Orioles?
Well, that was a tempestuous time there. I inherited some good young pitchers, but most of them had some sort of arm trouble. Of course, Hanson had been an outstanding shortstop, but he was spending some time in the service, so it didn't have full time for him, you know. And
mm-hmm.
Jerry Adair, who's normally second baseman, shortstop. And of course Steve Barber spent a lot of time in the service, and you know, to get him on the weekends, and he wasn't in shape. So Estrada came up with a bad arm. I'm not making excuses, I'm just telling you where it was.
Right.
But we had a good ball club. Jim Teal had a great year the year before, you know, hit 42 home runs, drove in 115, 20 runs. And Jim had an off year. Those things just didn't work out like we hoped, you know.
But nonetheless, you were successful. There are very few managers with your record.
That's appreciated.
Your first game as manager, 1960, you sandwiched between Jimmy Dykes and Joe Gordon.
That was a one shot deal in Yankee Stadium. Jimmy had was managing the club, and Dykes, and one of the greatest guys I ever played for, ever worked for. Big old rough talking guy, but had a heart as big as a mountain. And a good manager, Jimmy Dykes, was a fine baseball man. He just turned you loose and let you play. As long as you played for him, that was all right. But if you ever let down, oh boy, he'd beat you up.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Hurley and Jimmy Dykes had a little sort of a running feud going all the time. Looked like Ed Hurley was an umpire, and a good umpire, but he sort of had a chip on his shoulder, you know, and he didn't take much. But Dykes could really wake umpires over, you know. But they all liked him and respected him. Well, on this particular day in Yankee Stadium, that was a close play, and Dykes, when I complained on, pushed on it, Hurley was behind the plate. It was home plate. And he gave him a pretty good going over, but he didn't throw him out of the ball game. Well, the next day, Dykes said,